Oh, blighted, even self-respecting resurrectionists don't come here anymore. You? You're not taking the night patrol yourself, are you?
I couldn't sleep either. That damned comet.
Bowmans searched the sky.
Can't see it from here. Have to go around back.
You're right. Nobody knows we're here anymore. Us or those things in the ground over there. I don't know what's worse. Neglect or plain stupidity. Something was gnawing at the monitor.
Bo, they're not replacing me because I'm old or incompetent, though I guess I'm enough of both. They're moving me out so somebody's nephew can have a post. An exile for a black sheep. That hurts, Bo. That really hurts. They've forgotten what this place is. They're telling me I wasted my whole life doing a job any idiot can sleep his way through.
The world is full of fools. Fools die. Eh?
They laugh when I talk about the comet or about resurrectionists striking this summer. They can't believe that I believe. They don't believe there's anything under those mounds. Not anything still alive.
Bring them out here. Walk them through the Barrowland after dark.
I tried. They told me to quit whining if I wanted a pension.
You've done all you can, then. It's on their heads.
I took an oath, Bo. I was serious about it then, and I'm serious now. This job is all I have. You've got Jasmine and Stance. I might as well have been a monk. Now they're discarding me for some young...
He began making strange noises. Sobs, Bowmans thought. From the monitor. From this man with a heart of flint and all the mercy of a shark. He took Bisan's elbow.
Let's go look at the comet. I haven't seen it yet.
Bisan got hold of himself.
You haven't? That's hard to believe.
Why, I haven't been up late. Stancil has done the night work.
Never mind. Slipping into my antagonistic character again. We should have been lawyers, you and I. We've got the argumentative turn of mind.
You could be right. Spent a lot of time lately wondering what I'm doing out here.
What are you doing here, Bo?
I was going to get rich. I was going to study the old books, open a few rich graves, go back to ore, and buy into my uncle's drayage business. Idly, Bowmans wondered how much of his faked past Bisand accepted. He had lived it so long that he now remembered some fraudulent anecdotes as factual, unless he thought hard.
What happened?
Laziness. Plain old-fashioned laziness. I found out there's a big difference between dreaming and getting in there and doing. It was easier to dig just enough to get by and spend the rest of the time loafing. Bowmans made a sour face. He was striking near the truth. His researches were, in fact, partly an excuse for not competing. He simply did not have the drive of a Tokar.
You haven't had too bad a life. One or two hard winters when Stancil was a pup, but we all went through those. A helping hand here or there, and we all survived.
There she is, Bisand indicated the sky over the Barrowland. Bowmans gasped. It was exactly what he had seen in his dreams.
Showy, isn't it? Wait till it gets close. It'll fill half the sky.
Pretty, too.
Stunning, I'd say.
But also a harbinger. An ill omen. The old writers say it'll keep returning until the Dominator is freed.
I've lived with that stuff most of my life, Bisand, and even I find it hard to believe there's anything to it.
Wait. I get that spooky feeling around the Barrowland, too. But I just can't believe those creatures could rise again after 400 years in the ground.
Bo, maybe you are honest. If you are, take a hint. When I leave, you leave. Take the Tel Curry stuff and head for Orr.
You're starting to sound like Stance.
I mean it. Some idiot unbeliever kid takes over here, all hell is going to break loose. Literally. Get out while you can.
You could be right. I'm thinking about going back. But what would I do? I don't know Orr anymore. The way Stance tells it, I'd get lost.
Hell, this is home now. I never really realized that.
This dump is home.
I know what you mean.
Bowman's looked at that great silver blade in the sky. Soon, now.
What's going on out there? Who is that?
Came from Bowman's back door.
You clear off here. I'll have the guard after you.
It's me, Jasmine. Bisand laughed.
And the monitor, mistress. The guard is here already.
Bo, what are you doing?
Talking. Looking at the stars.
I'll be getting along, Bisand said.
See you tomorrow. From his tone, Bowman's knew tomorrow would be a day of normal harassments.
Take care.
He settled on the dewy back step, let the cool night wash over him. Birds called in the old forest, their voices lonely. A cricket chirruped optimistically. Humid air barely stirred the remnants of his hair. Jasmine came out and sat beside him.
Couldn't sleep, he told her.
Me either.
Must be going around.
He glanced at the comet, was startled by an instant of déjà vu.
Remember the summer we came here, when we stayed up to see the comet? It was a night like this.
She took his hand, entwined her fingers with his.
You're reading my mind. Our first month anniversary.
Those were fool kids, those two.
They still are. Inside. Chapter 11 The Barrowland. For Corby, the unraveling came quickly now, when he kept his mind on business. But more and more he became distracted by that old silk map. Those strange old names. In Telcurry they had a ring absent in modern tongues. Soulcatcher, Stormbringer, Moonbiter, the Hanged Man. They seemed so much more potent in the old tongue. But they were dead. The only great ones left were the lady and the monster who started it all, out there under the earth. Often he went to a small window and stared toward the Barrowland. The devil in the earth. Calling, perhaps. Surrounded by lesser champions, few of them recalled in the legends, and few the old wizard identified, Bowman's had been interested only in the lady. So many fetishes, and a dragon, and fallen champions of the White Rose, their shades set to eternal guard duty. It seemed so much more dramatic than the struggle today. Corby laughed. The past was always more interesting than the present. For those who lived through the first great struggle, it must have seemed deadly slow, too. Only in the final battle were the legends and legacies created, a few days out of decades. He worked less now that he had a sound place to live and a little saved. He spent more time wandering, especially by night. Case came calling one morning, before Corby was fully wakened. He allowed the youth inside.
Tea?
All right.
You're nervous. What is it?
Colonel Sweet wants you.
Chess again, or work?
Neither. He's worried about your wandering around at night. I told him I'd go with you, and all you do is look at the stars and stuff. Guess he's getting paranoid.
Corby smiled a smile he did not feel.
Just doing his job?
Guess my life looks odd. Getting past it, lost in my own mind.
Do I act senile sometimes?
Here, sugar.
Please.
Sugar was a treat. The guard could not provide it.
Any rush? I haven't eaten.
He didn't put it that way.
Good.
More time to prepare. Fool. He should have guessed his walks would attract attention. The guard was paranoid by design. Corby prepared oats and bacon, which he shared with Case. For all they were well paid, the guard ate poorly. Because of ongoing foul weather, the ore road was all but impassable. The army quartermasters strove valiantly, but often could not get through.
"Well, let's see the man," Corby said. "And that's the last bacon. The colonel better think about farming here, just in case."
They talked about it.
Corby had befriended Case, partly because he served at headquarters. Colonel Sweet would play chess and talk old times, but he never revealed any plans.
"And?"
"Not enough land. Not enough fodder."
"Pigs. They get fat on acorns."
"Need herdsmen.
else the tribemen would get them.
I guess so.
The colonel ushered Corby into his private quarters. Corby joked,
"Don't you ever work, sir?"
"The operation runs itself. Been rolling 4 centuries. That's the way it goes." "I have a problem, Corby."
Corby grimaced. "Sir?"
"Appearances, Corby. This is a world that lives by perceptions. You aren't presenting a proper appearance."
"Sir?"
"We had a visitor last month, from Charm."
"I didn't know that."
"Neither did anyone else, except me. What you might call a prolonged surprise inspection. They happen occasionally."
Sweet settled behind his work table, pushed aside the chess set over which they had contested so often. He drew a long sheet of southern paper from a cubby at his right knee. Corby glimpsed printing in a crabbed hand.
"Taken, sir?"
Corby never sirred anyone, except as an afterthought. The habit disturbed Sweet. "Yes, with the ladies' carte blanche. He did not abuse it, but he did make recommendations, and he did mention people whose behavior he found unacceptable. Your name was first on the list. What the hell are you doing wandering around all night?"
"Thinking. I can't sleep. The war did something. The things I saw, the guerrillas. You don't want to go to sleep because they might attack. If you do sleep, you dream about the blood. Homes and fields burning, animals and children screaming. That was the worst. The babies crying. I still hear the babies crying."
He exaggerated very little. Each time he went to bed, he had to get past the crying of babes. He told most of the truth and wound it into an imaginative lie. Babies crying. The babies who haunted him were his own. Innocence abandoned in a moment of fear of commitment.
"I know," Sweet replied. "I know. At Rust, they killed their children rather than let us capture them. The hardest men in the regiment wept when they saw the mothers hurling their infants down from the walls, then jumping after them. I never married. I have no children. But I know what you mean. Did you have any?"
"A son," Corby said, in a voice both soft and strained, from a body almost shaking with pain.
"And a daughter. Twins, they were. Long ago and far away."
"And what became of them?"
"I don't know. I would hope they're still living. They would be about Case's age."
Sweet raised an eyebrow, but let the remark slide past. "And their mother?" Corby's eyes became iron. Hot iron, like a brand.
"Dead.
I'm sorry." Corby did not respond. His expression suggested he was not sorry himself. "You understand what I'm saying, Corby?" Sweet asked. "You were noticed by one of the Taken. That's never healthy."
"I get the message. Which was it?"
"I can't say. Which of the Taken or where, when, could be of interest to the rebel?" Corby snorted.
"What rebel? We wiped them out at Charm."
"Perhaps, but there is that White Rose."
"I thought they were going to get her."
"Yeah, the stories you hear. Going to have her in chains before the month is out. Been saying that since first we heard of her. She's light on her feet. Maybe light enough." Sweet's smile faded. "At least I won't be around next time the comet comes. Brandy?"
"Yes."
"Chess? Or do you have a job?"
"Not right away. I'll go you one game."
Halfway through, Sweet said, "Remember what I said, eh? The Taken claimed he was leaving, but there's no guarantee. Could be behind a bush someplace watching."
"I'll pay more attention to what I'm doing."
He would. The last thing he wanted was a Taken interested in him. He had come too far to waste himself now.
Chapter 12. The Plain of Fear.
I had the watch. My belly gnawed, weighted by lead. All day dots had traversed the sky, high up. A pair were there now, patrolling.
The continuous presence of Taken was not a good omen. Closer, 2 manta pairs planed the afternoon air.
They would ride the updrafts, then circle down, taunting the Taken, trying to lure them across the boundary. They resented outsiders, the more so these, because these would crush them but for Darling, another intruder. Walking trees were on the move beyond the creek. The dead menhirs glistened, somehow changed from their usual dullness. Things were happening on the plain. No outsider could comprehend their import fully. One great shadow clung to the desert. Way up there, daring the Taken, a lone wind whale hovered. An occasional, barely perceptible bass roar tumbled down. I'd never heard one talk before. They do so only when enraged. A breeze muttered and whimpered in the coral. Old Father Tree sang counterpoint to the wind whale. A menhir spoke behind me.
"Your enemies come soon."
I shivered. It recalled the flavor of a nightmare I've been having lately. I can recall no specifics afterward, only that it is filled with terror. I refused to be unsettled by the sneaky stone. Much. What are they? Where did they come from? Why are they different from normal stones? For that matter, why is the plain ridiculously different? Why so bellicose? We are here on sufferance only, allied against a greater enemy. Shatter the lady, and see how our friendship prospers. How soon?
When they are ready.
Brilliant, old stone. Positively illuminating. My sarcasm did not go unnoticed, just unremarked. The menhirs have their own flair for sarcasm and the sharp-edged tongue.
5 armies, said the voice. They will not wait long.
I indicated the sky. The Taken cruise at will, unchallenged.
They have not challenged.
True, but a weak excuse. Allies should be allies. More, wind whales and mantas usually consider appearance on the plain sufficient challenge. It occurred to me that Taken might have bought them off.
Not so.
The menhir had moved. Its shadow now fell across my toes. I finally looked. This one was just 10 feet tall, a real runt. It had guessed my thought. Damn. It continued telling me what I already knew.
It is not possible to deal from a position of strength always. Take care. There has been a call to the peoples to reassess your acceptance on the plain.
So, this over-talkative hunk was an emissary. The natives were scared. Some thought they could save themselves trouble by booting us out. Yes. The peoples does not properly describe the parliament of species that makes decisions here, but I know no better title. If the menhirs are to be believed, and they lie only by omission or indirection, over 40 intelligent species inhabit the plane of fear. Those I know include menhirs, walking trees, wind whales and mantas, a handful of humans, both primitives and hermits, 2 kinds of lizard, a bird like a buzzard, a giant white bat, and an extremely scarce critter that looks like a camel centaur put together backward. I mean, the humanoid half is behind. The creature runs toward what most would take as its fanny. No doubt I have encountered others without recognizing them. Goblin says there is a tiny rock monkey that lives in the hearts of the great coral reefs. He claims it looks like a miniature one-eye, but Goblin is not to be trusted where one eye is concerned.
I am charged with delivering a warning,
the menhir said.
There are strangers on the plain.
I asked questions. When it did not answer, I turned, irritably. It was gone. Damned stone. Tracker and his mutt stood in the mouth of the hole, watching the Taken. Darling interviewed Tracker thoroughly, I'm told. I missed that. She was satisfied. I had an argument with Elmo. Elmo liked Tracker. Reminds me of Raven, he said. We could use a few 100 ravens. Reminds me of Raven, too, and that's what I don't like. But what good arguing? We cannot always like everyone. Darling thinks he is all right. Elmo thinks so. The lieutenant accepts him. Why should I be different?
Hell, if he is from the same mold as Raven, the lady is in trouble. He will be tested soon enough. Darling has something in mind, something preemptive, I suspect, possibly toward Rust. Rust, where the Limper had raised his Stela. The Limper, back from the dead. I did everything but burn the body. Should have done that, I guess. Bloody hell. The scary part is wondering if he is the only one. Did others survive apparent, certain death? Are they hidden away now, waiting to astound the world? A shadow fell across my feet. I returned to the living. Tracker stood beside me. "You look distressed," he said. He did show one every courtesy, I must admit. I looked toward those patrolling reminders of the struggle. I said, "I'm a soldier, grown old and tired and confused. I have been fighting since before you were born, and I have yet to see anything gained." He smiled a thin, almost secretive smile. It made me uncomfortable. Everything he did made me uncomfortable. Even his damned dog made me uncomfortable, and it did nothing but sleep. Much as it loafed, how had it managed to journey from ore? Too much like work. I swear, that dog won't even get in a hurry to eat. "Be of good faith, Croaker," Tracker said. "She will fall." He spoke with absolute conviction. "She hasn't the strength to tame the world." There was that scariness again. True or not, the way he expressed the sentiment was disturbing. "We'll bring them all down," he indicated the Taken. "They aren't real, like those of old." Toad Killer Dog sneezed on Tracker's boot. He looked down. I thought he would kick the mutt, but instead he bent to scratch the dog's ear. "Toad Killer Dog, what kind of name is that?" "Oh, it's an old joke, from when we were both a lot younger. He took a shine to it, insists on it now." Tracker seemed only half there. His eyes were vacant, his gaze far away, though he continued to watch the Taken. Weird. At least he admitted to having been young. There was a hint of human vulnerability in that. It is the apparent invulnerability of characters like Tracker and Raven that rattles me. Chapter 13. The Plane of Fear.
"Yo, Croaker," the lieutenant had come outside.
"What?"
"Let Tracker cover you."
I had only minutes left in my watch.
"Darling wants you."
I glanced at Tracker. He shrugged.
"Go ahead."
He assumed a stance facing westward. I swear it was like he turned the vigilance on, as though on the instant he became the ultimate sentinel. Even Toad Killer Dog opened an eye and went to watching. I brushed the dog's scalp with my fingers as I left, what I thought a friendly gesture. He growled.
"Be like that," I said, and joined the lieutenant.
He seemed disturbed. Generally, he is a cold customer.
"What is it?"
"She's got one of her wild hairs."
"Oh, boy."
"What?"
"Rust."
"Oh, yeah, brilliant. Get it all over with fast. I thought that was just talk. I trust you tried to argue her out of it."
You would think a man would grow accustomed to stench after having lived with it for years, but as we descended into the hole, my nose wrinkled and tightened. You just can't keep a bunch of people stuffed in a pit without ventilation. We have precious little.
"I tried. She says, 'Load the wagon. Let me worry about the mule being blind.'
She's right most of the time.
She's a damned military genius. But that don't mean she can pull off any cockamamie scheme she dreams up. Some dreams are nightmares. Hell, Croaker, the Limper is out there."
Which is where we started when we reached the conference room. Silent and I bore the brunt because we are Darling's favorites. Seldom do I see such unanimity among my brethren. Even Goblin and One Eye spoke with a single voice, and those two will fight over whether it is night or day with the sun at high noon. Darling prowled like a caged beast. She had doubts. They nagged her. "Two Taken in Rust," I argued. "That's what Corder said. One of them our oldest and nastiest enemy."
Break them, and we will shatter their entire plan of campaign, she countered. Break them? Girl, you're talking about the Limper. I proved he is invincible before. No, you proved that he will survive unless you are thorough. You might have burned him.
Yeah, or cut him into pieces and fed him to the fish, or given him a swim in a vat of acid or a dust bath in quicklime. But those things take time. We had the lady herself coming down on us. We barely got away as it was.
Assuming we can get there undetected, which I do not believe for a moment, and manage total surprise, how long before all the Taken get on us? I signed vigorously, more angry than frightened. I never refuse, darling, ever, but this time I was ready. Her eyes flashed. For the first time ever, I saw her battle her temper. She signed, "If you will not accept orders, you should not be here. I am not the lady. I do not sacrifice pawns for small gain. I agree, there is great risk in this operation, but far less than you argue, with potential impact far greater than you suppose. Convince me." "That I cannot do. If you are captured, you must not know." I was primed. "You just telling me that is enough for the Taken to get on a trail." Maybe I was more scared than I could admit. Or maybe it was just an all-time case of the contraries. "No," she signed. There was something more, but she held it back. Silent dropped a hand on my shoulder. He had given up. The lieutenant joined him.
"You're overstepping yourself, Croker."
Darling repeated, "If you will not accept orders, Croker, leave." She meant it. Really? I stood with mouth open, stunned.
"All right."
I stamped out. I went to my quarters, shuffled those obstinate old papers, and, of course, found not a damned thing new. They left me alone for a while. Then Elmo came. He did not announce himself. I just glanced up and found him leaning against the doorframe. By then, I was half ashamed of my performance.
"Yeah?"
"Mail call," he said, and tossed me another of those oilskin packets. I snapped it out of the air. He departed without explaining its appearance. I placed it on my work table, wondered. Who? I knew no one in Orr. Was it some sort of trick? The lady is patient and clever. I would not put past her some grand maneuver using me. I guess I must have thought about it an hour before, reluctantly, I opened the packet. Chapter 14. The Story of Bowmans. Croker. Bowmans and Tokar stood in one corner of the shop. "What do you think?" Bowmans asked. "Bring a good price." Tokar stared at the pièce de résistance of Bowmans's new Tel Curry collection, a skeleton in perfectly restored armor. "It's marvelous, Bo. How did you do it?" "Wired the joints together. See the forehead, Jewel. I'm not up on domination heraldry, but wouldn't a ruby mean somebody important?"
"A king. That would be the skull of King Broke."
"His bones, too, and armor."
"You're rich, Bo. I'll just take a commission on this one. A wedding present to the family. You took me serious when I said come up with something good."
"The monitor confiscated the best. We had shapeshifter's armor." Tokar had brought helpers this trip, a pair of hulking gorilla teamsters. They were carrying antiques to wagons outside. Their back and forth made Bowmans nervous.
"Really? Damn, I'd give my left arm for that."
Bowman spread his hands apologetically.
"What could I do? Besand keeps me on a short leash. Anyway, you know my policy. I'm stretching it to deal with a future daughter-in-law's brother."
"How's that?" "Stuck my foot in it now," Bowman's thought. He plowed ahead.
"Besand has heard you're a resurrectionist. Stance and I are getting a hard time."
"Now that's sick. I'm sorry, Bo. Resurrectionist. I shot my mouth off once, years ago, and said even the Dominator would be better for Orr than our clown mayor. One stupid remark.
They never let you forget. It's not enough that they hounded my father into an early grave. Now they have to torment me and my friends." Bowmans had no idea what Tokar was talking about. He would have to ask Stance, but it reassured him, which was all he really wanted. "Tokar, keep the profits from this lot, for Stance and Glory, as my wedding present. Have they set a date?"
"Nothing definite. After his sabbatical and thesis. Come winter, I guess. Thinking about coming down?"
"Thinking about moving back to Orr. I don't have enough fight left to break in a new monitor." Tokar chuckled.
"Probably won't be much call for domination artifacts after this summer, anyway. I'll see if I can find you a place. You do work like the king here. You won't have trouble making a living."
"You really like it. I was thinking about doing his horse, too." Bowmans felt a surge of pride in his craftsmanship.
"Horse? Really? They buried his horse with him?"
"Armor and all. I don't know who put the Tel'Kuri in the ground, but they didn't loot. We've got a whole box of coins and jewelry and badges."
"Domination coinage? That's hotter than hot. Most of it was melted down. A domination coin in good shape can bring 50 times its metal value."
"Leave King Huzis here. I'll put his horse together for him, pick him up next trip."
"I won't be long, either. I'll unload and zip right back. Where's Stance, anyway? I wanted to say hello."
Tokar waved one of those leather wallets.
"Glory?"
"Glory. She ought to write romances. Going to break me buying paper." "He's out to the dig. Let's go."
"Jasmine, I'm taking Tokar out to the dig."
During the walk, Bowmans kept glancing over his shoulder. The comet was now so bright it could be seen, barely, by day.
"Going to be one hell of a sight when it peeks out," he predicted.
"I expect so." Tokar's smile made Bowmans nervous. "I'm imagining," he told himself.
Stancil used his back to open the shop door. He dumped a load of weapons.
"We're getting mined out, Pop. Pretty much all common junk last night."
Bowmans twisted a strand of copper wire, wriggled out of the framework supporting the horse skeleton.
"Then let Men Fu take over. Not much more room here anyway." The shop was almost impassable. Bowmans would not have to dig for years, were that his inclination.
"Looking good," Stance said of the horse, tarrying before going for another armful from a borrowed cart.
"You'll have to show me how to get the king on top so I can put them together when I go back."
"I may do it myself."
"Thought you'd decided to stay."
"Maybe. I don't know. When are we going to start that thesis?"
"I'm working on it, making notes. Once I get organized, I can write it up like that."
He snapped his fingers.
"Don't worry. I've got plenty of time."
He went outside again. Jasmine brought tea.
"I thought I heard Stance."
Bowmans jerked his head. "Outside." She looked for a place to set teapot and cups.
"You're going to have to get this mess organized."
"I keep telling myself that." Stancil returned.
"Enough odds and ends here to make a suit of armor, long as nobody tries to wear it."
"Tea?" his mother asked.
"Sure. Pop, I came past headquarters. That new monitor is here."
"Already? You're going to love him. He brought a coach and 3 wagons filled with clothing for his mistress, and a platoon of servants."
"What? Ha! He'll die when Bisan shows him his quarters."
The monitor lived in a cell more fit for a monk than for the most powerful man in the province.
"He deserves it."
"You know him?"
"By reputation. Polite people call him the Jackal. If I'd known it was him, what could I have done?"
"Nothing. He's lucky his family got him sent here. Somebody would have him killed if he stayed around the city."
"Not popular, eh?"
"You'll find out if you stay.
Come back, Pop."
"I've got a job to do, Stance."
"How much longer?"
"A couple of days. Or forever. You know, I've got to get that name."
"Pop, we could try now, while things are confused."
"No experiments, Stance. I want it cold. I won't take chances with the 10. Stancil wanted to argue, but sipped tea instead. He went out to the cart again.
When he returned, he said, "Tokar should be turned around by now. Maybe he'll bring more than two wagons."
Bowmans chuckled. "Maybe he'll bring more than wagons, you mean? Like, maybe a sister?"
"I was thinking that, yes."
"How are you going to get a thesis written?"
"There's always a spare moment."
Bowmans ran a dustcloth over the jewel in the brow of his dead king's horse.
"Enough for now, Dobbin. Going out to the dig."
"Swing by and check the excitement," Stancil suggested.
"I wouldn't miss it."
Besant came to the dig that afternoon. He caught Bowman's napping.
"What's this?" he demanded. "Sleeping on the job?"
Bowman sat up.
"You know me. Just getting out of the house. I hear the new man showed up."
Besant spat.
"Don't mention him."
"Bad?"
"Worse than I expected. Mark me, Bo. Today writes the end of an era. Those fools will rue it."
"You decide what you're going to do."
"Go fishing. Bloody go fishing. As far from here as I can get. Take a day to break him in, then head south.
I always wanted to retire to one of the jewel cities. I've never seen the sea.
So you're headed out right away, eh?"
"You don't have to sound so damn cheerful about it.
You and your resurrectionist friends have won, but I'll go knowing you didn't beat me on my own ground."
"We haven't fought much lately. That's no reason to make up for lost time."
"Yeah, yeah. That was uncalled for. Sorry. It's frustration. I'm helpless, and everything is going under."
"It can't be that bad."
"It can. I have my sources, Bo. I'm not some lone crazy. There are knowledgeable men in Orr who fear the same things I do. They say the resurrectionists are going to try something."
"You'll see, too, unless you get out."
"I probably will. Stancil knows this guy, but I can't go before we finish the dig."
Besant gave him a narrow-eyed look.
"Bo, I ought to make you clean up before I go. Looks like hell puked here."
Bowman's was not a fastidious worker. For 100 feet around his pit, the earth was littered with bones, useless scraps of old gear, and miscellaneous trash. A gruesome sight. Bowman's did not notice.
"Why bother? It'll be overgrown in a year. Besides, I don't want to make Menfu work any harder than he has to."
"You're all heart, Bo."
"I work at it."
"See you around."
"All right."
And Bowmans tried to puzzle out what he had done wrong, what Besand had come for and not found. He shrugged, snuggled into the grass, closed his eyes. The woman beckoned. Never had the dream been so clear, and never so successful. He went to her and took her hand, and she led him along a cool, green, tree-lined path. Thin shafts of sunlight stabbed through the foliage. Golden dust danced in the beams. She spoke, but he could not decipher her words. He did not mind. He was content. Gold became silver. Silver became a great, blunt blade, stabbing a nighttime sky, obscuring the weaker stars. The comet came down, and a great female face opened upon him. It was shouting, shouting angrily, and he could not hear. The comet vanished. A full moon rode the diamond-studded sky. A great shadow crossed the stars, obscuring the Milky Way. A head, Bowmans realized. A head of darkness. A wolf's head, snapping at the moon. Then it was gone. He was with the woman again, walking that forest path, tripping over sunbeams. She was promising him something. He wakened. Jasmine was shaking him.
"Bo! You're dreaming again. Wake up."
"I'm all right," he mumbled. "It wasn't that bad."
"You've got to stop eating so many onions.
A man your age, and with an ulcer."
Bowman sat up, patted his paunch. The ulcer had not bothered him lately. Maybe he had too much else on his mind. He swung his feet to the floor and stared into the darkness.
"What are you doing?"
"Thinking about going out to see Stance."
"You need your rest."
"Bull. Old as I am.
Old people don't need to rest. Can't afford to. Don't have the time left to waste. He felt for his boots. Jasmine muttered something typical. He ignored her. He had that down to a fine art. She added, "Take care out there."
"Eh? Be careful. I don't feel comfortable now that Bisand is gone."
"He only left this morning."
"Yes, but..."
Bowman's left the house muttering about superstitious old women who could not stand change. He took a random roundabout route, occasionally pausing to watch the comet. It was spectacular, a great mane of glory. He wondered if his dream had been trying to tell him something, a shadow devouring the moon. Not solid enough, he decided. Nearing the edge of town, he heard voices. He softened his step. People were not usually out at this time of night. They were inside an abandoned shack. A candle flickered inside. Pilgrims, he supposed. He found a peephole, but he could see nothing save a man's back. Something about those slumped shoulders. Bisand? Of course not. Too wide. More like that one ape of Tokar's. He could not identify the voices, which were mostly whispers. One did sound a lot like Menfu's habitual whine. The words were distinct enough, though.
"Look, we did everything we could to get him out of here. You take a man's job and home, he ought to realize he's not wanted. But he won't go."
A second voice.
"Then it's time for heroic measures."
Whiny voice.
"That's going too far."
Short of disgust.
"Yellow, I'll do it. Where is he?"
"Hold up in the old stable, the loft. Fixed himself a pallet, like an old dog in a corner."
A grunt as someone rose, feet moving. Bowman's grabbed his belly, Mouse stepped away and hid in a shadow. A hulking figure crossed the road. Comet light glittered upon a naked blade. Bowman scuttled to a more distant shadow and stopped to think. What did it mean? Murder, surely. But who? Why? Who had moved into the abandoned stable? Pilgrims and transients used the empty places all the time. Who were those men? Possibilities occurred. He banished them. They were too grim. When his nerves returned, he hurried to the dig. Stancil's lantern was there, but he was nowhere in sight. "Stance?" No answer. "Stancil, where are you?" Still no answer. Almost in panic, he shouted, "Stancil!
That you, Pop? Where are you?"
"Taking a crap." Bowman sighed, sat down. His son appeared a moment later, brushing sweat off his forehead. Why, it was a cool night. "Stance, did Bisand change his mind? I saw him leaving this morning. A while ago I heard men plotting to kill somebody. Sounded like they meant him."
"Kill? Who?"
"I don't know. One of them might have been Menfu. There were three or four of them. Did he come back?"
"I don't think so. You didn't dream something, did you? What are you doing out in the middle of the night, anyway?"
"That nightmare again. I couldn't sleep. I didn't imagine it. Those men were going to kill somebody because he wouldn't leave."
"That doesn't make sense, Pop."
"I don't care." Bowman's whirled. He heard the strange noise again. A figure staggered into the light. It took three steps and fell.
"Bisand! It is Bisand! What did I tell you?"
The former monitor had a bloody wound across his chest.
"I'm okay," he said. "I'll be okay. Just shock. It's not as bad as it looks."
"What happened?"
"Tried to kill me. Told you all hell would break loose. Told you they'd make a play. Beat them this round, though. Got their assassin instead."
"I thought you left. I saw you leave."
"I changed my mind. Couldn't go. I took an oath, Bo. They took away my job, but not my conscience. I've got to stop them."
Bowman's met his son's gaze. Stancil shook his head.
"Pop, look at his wrist."
Bowman's looked.
"I don't see anything." "That's the point. His amulet is gone."
"He turned it in when he left."
"Didn't you?"
"No," Bisand said. "Lost it in the fight. Couldn't find it in the dark.
He made that funny sound. "Pop, he's bad hurt. I better go to the barracks."
"Stance," Besand gasped. "Don't tell him. Get Corporal Husky."
"Right," Stancil hurried off. The light of the comet filled the night with ghosts. The Barrowland seemed to twist and crawl. Momentary shapes drifted among the brush. Bowmans shuddered and tried to convince himself that his imagination was acting up now. Dawn was approaching. Besand was over his shock, sipping broth Jasmine had sent. Corporal Husky came to report the result of his investigation.
"Couldn't find anything, sir. Not no body, not no amulet, not even no sign of no fight. It's like it never happened."
"I sure as hell didn't try to kill myself."
Bowmans became thoughtful. Had he not overheard the conspirators, he would have doubted Besand. The man was capable of staging an assault for sympathy.
"I believe you, sir. I was just saying what I found."
"They blew their best chance. We're warned now. Keep alert."
"Better not forget who's in charge now," Bowmans interjected. "Don't get anybody in trouble with our new leader."
"That rock brain."
"Do what you can, Husky. Don't crawl out on a limb."
"Yes, sir." The corporal departed. Stancil said, "Pop, you ought to get back to the house. You're looking gray." Bowmans rose. "You all right now?" he asked. Besand replied,
"I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. The sun is up. That kind don't try anything in broad daylight."
Don't bet on it, Bowmans thought. Not if they're devotees of the domination. They'll bring the darkness to high noon. Out of earshot, Stancil said, "I was thinking last night, Pop, before this got started, about our name problem. And suddenly it hit me. There's an old stone in Orr, a big one with runic carvings and pictographs. Been around forever. Nobody knows what it is or where it came from. Nobody really cares."
"So?"
"Let me show you what's carved on it." Stancil picked up a twig, brushed a dusty area clear of debris. He started drawing. "There's a crude star in a circle at the top, then some lines of runes nobody can read. I can't remember those. Then some pictures." He sketched rapidly.
"That's pretty rough."
"So is the original. But look, this one. Stick figure with a broken leg. Here. A worm? Here, a man superimposed over an animal. Here, a man with a lightning bolt, you see? The Limper, Nightcrawler, Shifter, Stormbringer."
"Maybe. And maybe you're reaching."
Stancil kept drawing. "Okay, that's the way they are on the rock, the four I named. In the same order as on your chart. Look here, at your empty spots. They could be the Taken whose graves we haven't identified." He tapped what looked like a simple circle, a stick figure with its head cocked, and a beast head with a circle in its mouth.
"The positions match," Bowmans admitted.
"So?"
"So what?"
"You're being intentionally thick, Pop. A circle is a zero, maybe. Maybe a sign for the one called the Faceless Man, or Nameless Man. And here, the Hanged Man. And here, Moondog or Moonbiter."
"I see it, Stance. I'm just not sure I want to." He told Stance about having dreamed of a great wolf's head snapping at the moon.
"You see? Your own mind is trying to tell you. Go check the evidence. See if it don't fit this way."
"I don't have to."
"Why not?"
"I know it by heart. It fits."
"Well, then what's the matter?"
"I'm not sure I want to do it anymore."
"Pop?"
"Pop, if you won't, I will. I mean it. I'm not going to let you throw away 37 years.
What's changed, anyway? You gave up a hell of a future to come out here. Can you just write that off?"
"I'm used to this life. I don't mind it."
"Pop, I've met people who knew you back when. They all say you could have been a great wizard. They wonder what happened to you. They know that you had some secret plan and went off to chase it. They figured you're dead now, 'cause anybody with your talent would have been heard from. Right now, I'm wondering if they're not right." Bowman sighed. Stancil would never understand. Not without getting old under the threat of the noose.
I mean it, Pop. I'll do it myself.
No, you won't. You have neither the knowledge nor the skill.
I'll do it. I guess it's fated.
Let's go.
Not so eager. This isn't a tea party. It'll be dangerous. I need rest and time to get into the right frame of mind. I have to assemble my equipment and prepare the stage.
Pop? Stancil, who is the expert? Who is going to do this?
I guess you are.
Then shut your mouth and keep it shut. The quickest I could try is tomorrow night, assuming I stay comfortable with those names.
Stancil looked pained and impatient.
What's the hurry? What's your stake in it?
I think Tokar is bringing glory. I wanted everything out of the way when she got here.
Bowman's raised a despairing eyebrow. Let's go to the house. I'm exhausted.
He glanced back at Bisand, who was staring into the Barrowland.
The man was stiff with defiance.
Keep him out of my hair. He won't be getting around too good for a while.
Later, Bowman's muttered, I wonder what this is all about, anyway.
Really, resurrectionists?
Stancil said, The resurrectionists are a myth Bisand's bunch used to keep themselves employed.
Bowman's recalled some university acquaintances.
Don't be too sure.
When they reached the house, Stance trudged upstairs to study the chart. Bowman's ate a small meal. Before lying down, he told Jasmine,
Keep an eye on Stance. He's acting funny.
Funny? How?
I don't know. Just funny.
Pushy about the Barrowland. Don't let him find my gear. He might try to open the path himself.
He wouldn't.
I hope not. But watch him.
Chapter 15 The Barrowland. Case heard Corby was back at last. He ran to the old man's home. Corby greeted him with a hug.
How you been, lad?
We thought you were gone for good.
Corby had been away 8 months.
I tried to get back. There's damn near no roads anymore.
I know. The colonel asked the Taken to fly supplies in.
I heard. The military government in Orr got off their butts when that hit. Sent a whole regiment to start a new road. It's about a third of the way built. I came up on part of it.
Case donned his serious face.
Was it really your daughter?
No, Corby said.
On departing, he had announced that he was off to meet a woman who might be his daughter. He claimed to have given over his savings to a man who would find his children and bring them to Orr.
You sound disappointed.
He was. His researches had not worked out well. Too many records were missing.
What sort of winter was it, Case?
Bad.
It was bad down there, too. I worried for you all.
We had trouble with the tribes. That was the worst part. You can always stay inside and throw another log on, but you can't eat if thieves steal your stores.
I thought it might come to that.
We watched your house. They broke in some of the empty places.
Thank you. Corby's eyes narrowed. His home had been violated. How thoroughly? A careful searcher might have found enough to hang him. He glanced out a window.
Looks like rain.
It always looks like rain, when it don't look like snow. It got 12 feet deep last winter. People are worried.
What's happened to the weather?
Old folks say it goes this way after the great comet. The winters turn bad for a few years. Down in Orr it never got that cold. Plenty of snow, though.
Wasn't that cold here. Just snowed so much you couldn't get out. I like to went crazy. The whole Barrowland looked like a frozen lake. You could hardly tell where the Great Barrow was.
I have to unpack yet. If you don't mind, let everyone know I'm back. I'm near broke. I'll need work.
Will do, Corby.
Corby watched from a window as Case ambled back to the guard compound, taking an elevated walkway built since his departure. The mud below explained it. That and Colonel Sweet's penchant for keeping his men occupied. Once Case vanished, he went to the second floor. Nothing had been disturbed.
Good.
He peeped out a window toward the Barrowland.
How it had changed in just a few years.
A few more, and you would not be able to find it. He grunted, stared the harder. Then he retrieved the silken map from its hiding place, studied it, then the barrowland again. After a time, he fished sweat-stained papers from inside his shirt, where he had carried them since stealing them from the university in Orr. He spread them over the map. Late that afternoon he rose, donned a cloak, gathered the cane he now carried, and went out. He limped through the water and mud and drizzle till he reached a point overlooking the great tragic river. It was in flood, as always. Its bed had continued to shift. After a time he cursed, smote an old oak with his cane, and turned back. The day had gone gray with the hour. It would be dark before he got home. "Damned complications," he muttered. "I never counted on this. What the hell am I going to do?" Take the high risk, the one chance he wished most to avoid, though its possible necessity was his real reason for having wintered in Orr. For the first time in years, he wondered if the game were worth the candle. Whatever his course, it would be dark before he got home. Chapter 16. The Plane of Fear.
You get mad and walk out on Darling, you can miss a lot. Elmo, One Eye, Goblin, Otto, those guys like to bait me. They were not about to clue me in. They got everybody else to go along, even Tracker, who seemed to be taking a shine to me and chattered at me more than everybody else combined, would not drop a hint. So when the day came, I went topside in total ignorance. I'd packed the usual field gear. Our traditions are heavy infantry, though mostly we ride these days. All of us are too old to lug 80 pounds of gear. I dragged mine to the cavern that serves as a stable and smells like the grandfather of them all, and found that not one animal was saddled. Well, one. Darling's. The stable boy just grinned when I asked what was going on. "Go on up," he said. "Sir?" "Yeah? Rotten bastards. They play games with me. I'll get them. They damned well better start remembering who keeps the annals around here." I bitched and moaned all the way into the pre-moonset shadows that lurked around the tunnel mouth. There I found the rest of the outfit, all already up, with light gear. Each man carried his weapons and a sack of dried food. "What are you doing, Croaker?" One Eye asked with suppressed laughter. "Look like you're taking everything you own. You a turtle. Carry your house on your back." And Elmo, "We ain't moving, boy, just going on a raid." "You're a bunch of sadists, you know that?" I stepped into the wan light. The moon was half an hour from setting. Far, Taken drifted on the night. Those sons of bitches were determined to keep a close watch. Nearer, a whole horde of menhirs had gathered. They looked like a graveyard out on the desert, there were so many of them. There were a lot of walking trees, too. More, though there was no breeze, I could hear old Father Tree tinkling. No doubt that meant something. A menhir might have explained, but the stones remained close-mouthed about themselves and their fellow species, especially about Father Tree. Most of them won't admit he exists. "Better lighten your load, Croaker," the lieutenant said. He would not explain, either. "You going, too?" I asked, surprised. "Yep. Move it. We don't have long. Weapons and field medical kit should do it. Scoot." I met Darling going down. She smiled. Grouchy as I was, I smiled back. I can't stay mad at her. I have known her since she was so high, since Raven rescued her from the Limper's thugs long ago in the Forsberg campaigns. I cannot see the woman that is without recalling the child that was. I get all sentimental and soft. They tell me I suffer from a crippling romantic streak. Looking back, I'm almost inclined to agree. All those silly stories I wrote about the lady. The moon was on the rim of the world when I returned topside. A whisper of excitement coursed among the men.
Darling was up there with them, astride her flashy white mare, moving around, gesturing at those who understood sign. Above, the spots of luminescence that are characteristic of wind whale tentacles drifted lower than I'd ever heard tell of, except in horror stories about starved whales dropping down to drag their tentacles on the ground, ripping up every plant and animal in their path.
"Hey," I said, "we'd better look out. That sucker is coming down."
A vast shadow blotted out thousands of stars, and it was expanding. Mantas swarmed around it, big ones, little ones, in-between ones, more than I'd ever seen. My expostulation drew laughter. I turned surly again. I moved among the men, harassing them about the medical kits I expect them to carry on a mission. I was in a better mood when I finished. They all had them. The wind whale kept coming down. The moon disappeared. The instant it did, the menhirs began to move. Moments later, they began to glow on the side toward us, the side away from the Taken. Darling rode along the pathway they marked. When she passed a menhir, its light went out. I suspect it moved to the far end of the line. I had no time to check. Elmo and the lieutenant herded us into a line of our own. Above, the night filled with the squeaks and flutter of mantas squabbling for flying room. The wind whale settled astride the creek. My God, it was big. Big, I had no idea. It stretched from the coral over the creek another 200 yards, 400-500 yards long altogether, and 70 to 100 wide. A menhir spoke. I could not make out its words, but the men began moving forward. In a minute, my worst suspicions were confirmed. They were climbing the creature's flank onto its back, where mantas normally nested. It smelled. Smelled unlike anything I've ever smelled before, and strongly. Richly, you might say. Not necessarily a bad smell, but overpowering. And it felt strange to the touch. Not hairy, scaly, horny. Not exactly slimy, but still spongy and slick, like a full, exposed intestine. There were plenty of handholds. Our fingers and boots did not bother it. The menhir mumbled and grumbled like an old first sergeant, both issuing orders and relaying complaints from the wind whale. I got the impression the wind whale was a naturally grouchy sort. He did not like this any more than did I. Can't say I blame him. Up top, there were more menhirs, each balanced precariously. As I arrived, one menhir told me to go to another of its kind. That one told me to sit about 20 feet away. The last men climbed aboard only moments later. The menhirs vanished. I began to feel odd. At first blush, I thought that was because the whale was lifting off. When I flew with the lady or whisper or soul catcher, my stomach was in continual rebellion. But this was a different malaise. It took a while to understand it as an absence. Darling's null was fading. It had been with me so long, it had become part of my life. What was happening? We were going up. I felt the breeze shift. The stars turned ponderously. Then, suddenly, the whole north lighted up. Mantas were attacking the Taken, a whole mess of them.